getting to introduce Wendell Berry is kind of like, oh God, he is a God icon. In my life in Kentucky, he's always been there. And I don't know what to call him. I mean, role model is certainly inadequate. But he probably doesn't know that he was an English teacher at the University of Kentucky when I was an engineering student there. And of course, as an engineering student, I never went near the English department. So I didn't really know you then. But there was a time in my life when I went back to the farm, just about the same time you did, actually, and grew organic vegetables and sold them on the street corner in Lexington. Wendell was a writer for Organic Farming Magazine. You probably know. And he was one of the early and strong voices about the poisons in our food and what agribusiness was doing to the food chain. So that was the first time I really started paying a lot of attention to Wendell. He got arrested at Marble Hill, something which a lot of us at the time respected that act of civil disobedience and what it stood for, and there are probably a few other people in this audience who also got arrested with you there. But more than that, he never stopped. And even recently, you know, I'm sitting home and I live out in sort of in the woods, and you know, it's a nice place to be. And I'm thinking, you know, this is getting so bad in Kentucky when the coal companies own and operate our university, and they have one of these small coal burning units. When I was an engineering student at the university, it was a small old coal burning unit then. And they talk about clean coal. And we don't even have at our flagship university a coal burning unit that meets standards. Now tell me about that. That's the kind of state we live in. And our current leadership is unconscionable when it comes to coal and what they're allowing to happen. But we do have a conscience. And while I'm thinking about it, back in the woods staying home, Wendell's over in the governor's office, camped out. At least, you know, they probably treated him better there than they did at Marble Hill. But he stood up because he was sitting back on his farm thinking the same thing I was. You know, this is unconscionable, what's going on. We should not chop the tops off of mountains for a few tons of coal and a few pennies a ton. So he got out there on the streets and he got me off my farm, and I fortunately did get over to the march and heard you speak and the others speak who were standing up in our state, and more of us need to do it. And this is probably the wrong crowd to even talk about that, because I know so many of you, and I know all of you are out there doing your thing. But Wendell is our conscience, and we're so lucky that we have him, because if we didn't, I don't even know where we would be in terms of any kind of leadership on the issues that confront us in this state. Wendell? I told them they could sit and talk if they want to do it that way.
Is that the way we were doing it? I'll just, since I'm already here, I'll stay. Well, if I had my druthers, I would druther just go ahead and leave that introduction alone and say no more. But I don't want to get the EPA off our backs. If anything, I have to say I'm grateful to the EPA, and I have a lot of sympathy, actually, for you and your colleagues, because you're standing in a very difficult place, that is, between the bandits and the loot. Since I'm not working for the EPA or any other government office, I have the luxury of being a skeptic. And I think we need the EPA a lot more. We have a greater need for them than they can possibly fulfill. Since we're supposed to be talking about air, and I still believe in the four elements, I know that we can't really specialize that much. We've got, in the first place, if we're going to have poisons for the air and water, we've got to dig them up. And then we've got to set them on fire. And the hymn that's been going round and round in my mind for quite a long time now is the one that says, God gave Noah the rainbow sign, no more water, the fire next time. These four elements have to be kept in balance. And I think fire is out of control at the moment. It's hard to believe that the world's on fire, but it is. It's on fire in our power plants. It's on fire in our automobiles. It's on fire in all the workings of this earth-destroying economy. So I don't really rest very comfortably with the proposition that there's no necessary conflict between the so-called environment and the so-called economy. I think they're in direct conflict, and I don't see how on present terms the conflict can be resolved. If you keep digging this stuff up and burning it, you're going to have poison in the water and poison in the air. And nobody in Kentucky is free of this. The air in the Ohio River Valley is notoriously unfit to breathe. There's no water in the state really fit to swim in or eat the fish from. We are in league, those of us who are uneasy about this, with the EPA trying to make the best we can of what is, I think, fundamentally a bad situation. There's an op-ed piece by David Brooks in the New York Times today in favor of natural gas and fracking. David Brooks' condition is that there's no harm in this if everything goes okay. It's like our friend Mayor Abramson, who says that he's for mountaintop removal as long as it doesn't do any environmental damage. Well, we've had enough of this. The time's past when you can say that and get away with it, because the economy we're in is a failure, because it requires an environmental protection agency. That's one of the first symptoms. Moreover, David Brooks thinks this is 100% net. He goes so far as to call this natural gas a blessing. Well, good Lord. Folks, I mean, we here don't have to be ignorant and greedy by policy. And that means we don't have to believe that natural gas by fracking is 100% net good. Regulation will help. Some things can be regulated. Some things ought to be forbidden. Mountaintop removal ought to be forbidden. We ought to stop. Air pollution ought to be forbidden, but we don't know how to forbid it. Why should you put poison in the air that you breathe? That ought to be forbidden. all the best we can hope for is to taper it off over the next lifetime or two. So, I think I'll end just by saying that I'm going to hang on to my skepticism, and I'm going to take seriously the first public servant with anything to lose who will call for rationing energy.
I sort of figured he'd have something to say. Our next responder is Dr. Warren Muir. He's representing the scientist. And he is the, you look at all his credentials and degrees, he fits the category perfectly well. He's currently the executive director of the Division of Earth and Life Sciences of the National Academies. And if you know anything about the National Academies, you'll know that it's probably one of the most quiet and important functions that we have in terms of really understanding the environment and the planet we live on. And the people who work there and do the work they do provide the information that we must have to understand what we're doing to the planet. Dr. Muir's been doing it for a long time. He was at USEPA at one time from 1977 to 1981 and was in the first office of toxic chemicals. And as it turns out, he did something in his career that he's very proud of and helped us here in Louisville more than you can imagine, not just here in Louisville, but in every city in this country. Something called the Toxic Release Inventory. When I came to Louisville in 1984, we'd had the sewer explosion, the Hexoxta incident where the sewer plant was out of service, and 100 million gallons a day to the Ohio River, Valley of the Drums. We had a whole history. And still, in the early 1980s, if you were a fireman here in Louisville or somebody working down in the sewers, the chemical companies could discharge things into those sewers that you had no idea what they were. They didn't have to tell you. They didn't have to tell you how much it was, what they were doing with it, and what kind of harm it might do. And something came along called the Toxics Release Inventory, and it turns out that Warren Muir and another fellow did an op-ed piece in the New York Times at a critical time when Congress, which was hostile to it, and even EPA was hostile to it at the time, that turned. It was a tipping point, and the Toxic Release Inventory became law, and finally, these chemical companies had to at least just tell us what they had, what they were doing, and in terms of me doing my job here in Louisville and trying to protect the citizens here from the impacts of chemical spills and the danger and the risk that were associated with that, disclosure, all it was disclosure. They just had to tell us. Then they became slightly embarrassed. That was your point, right? So, thank you for helping get the Toxics Release Inventory as a matter of law, and that is, it's another one of the things that the lobbyists are, they've never liked it. They've been whittling away at it as best they can for decades, but Dr. Muir, we thank you for the TRI.
I think it's on? Yeah, it is on. Okay. Well, it's an honor to be here. This is the first time that I've spent any time at all in Louisville, and I participated in the panel this morning, and I must say I was rather struck by the issues that you have here. I'm also very honored to be on this panel. I've not met Gina McCarthy before. But I've been in Washington for 40 years, going back to having gone directly from grad school to the Nixon Council on Environmental Quality in 1971. And, the Environmental Protection Agency was set up in in the end of 1970, and it was moving forward, and there have been a number of people who have passed through. And many, many fine people have served at US EPA. But there are only a few that stand out over all the years. And Gina is one of those people. I've not met her before, but I can tell you that she is just very, very highly regarded as a straight-shooting, committed individual who's respected by the public interest community, respected by the regulatory community, and respected by her staff. It's a pleasure to be here with you. And one of the things I want to point out, I mentioned to her over lunch, is, you know, one of the things that you know, got sort of very passing coverage, I think, in the news, but which I think is really rather monumental, wasn't one of these big battles, you know, with the Congress, but she and her staff met with the auto industry, and they agreed to double the efficiency of automobiles and trucks in the United States in the very near term, with defined progress. I mean, it is just an enormous accomplishment that has not been given the adequate recognition. I'm in awe. So I also want to tell you from my experience, having served in the government, having served in the universities, having served the National Academy of Sciences, been an observer of sort of the science policy and environmental interface and so forth, that the very best in government are very good. They're operating with so many challenges that you wouldn't believe. And it isn't just the normal challenges of what you're you know, picking up in the news and the Congress and this and that. And I must say, I am concerned. I'm concerned for EPA, and I'm concerned for the country with some of the things that are not so present. And I'm not speaking for the National Academy of Sciences. All of our stuff's in our books, okay? I'm speaking as an individual who's been in and around Washington on the environmental scene for a number of decades. I am concerned that the regulatory process is becoming so cumbersome and so costly. There's so much paralysis by analysis that's being mandated, and many of those analysis mandates were included by people with environmental concerns. During the Carter administration, there were a number of additional steps to the regulatory process. My concern is that the regulatory process is getting so costly, so burdensome, that EPA, in order to justify taking an action and putting all of that effort to there, has to create a regulation that's this broad, where in an economy that's moving quickly, and problems that are changing, so by the time it comes out, it's inapplicable to a large fraction of the circumstances to which it applies. I'm concerned that EPA has to do a risk assessment associated with virtually all of its actions, and their risk assessments now take 10 years to develop and are 1,000 pages long, and even then, you know, once you've got 1,000 pages, it's easy enough for the Academy to find mistakes in it. I think that what's happening is that the process is accruing in a way that is counterproductive. I think we need to decide whether or not we think as a nation we can afford our environmental values, and I personally do, and if so, then we ought to pursue them and free the EPA and free others in order to get there. If the agency could act more nimbly, it would be more targeted, it would be more appropriate, it would have less adverse consequences and we would all be moving forward more quickly. And I don't know whether that's counter to your democracy point or not, but I can tell you that when I went to the Environmental Protection Agency in 1977, I was enacting a brand new law called the Toxic Substances Control Act. And my the assistant administrator for toxic substances, who had been a longtime friend of mine, he said, "Warren, I want you to pick one chemical and regulate it." He said, "I want you to be able to pick one." He said, "You find it and you do it." And I came back to him and I said, "Don't worry, boss, we'll go with asbestos. We have workers who are dying from mesothelioma. It's 100% associated with asbestos, and everybody dies from the disease. Nobody's going to challenge our science with respect to asbestos." And when I left 4 years later, it was maybe four more years before EPA could issue a regulation, which then was just tossed out in the courts. I mean, it cost millions and millions and millions of dollars for EPA to try and tackle that one problem. And I just think that we need to focus not only on keeping the agency and the agency funded and keeping a Clean Air Act and so forth, but if anything, I think we need to free civil servants committed to environmental protection to do the job. Thank you.
That makes me think of plausible deniability and how long in this state we denied that smoking was harmful. And consequently, we have one of the highest lung cancer rates today because we were so slow to acknowledge the truth. Times we live in. Roger Gottlieb is going to help us with another perspective, I hope, because he's looking at how we're dealing with issues, and in particularly in the context of the Festival of Faith, he's looking at religious environmentalism. And his most recent book is called A Greener Faith, Religious Environmentalism and Our Planet's Future. So he's right there looking at us and how we're behaving and how we need to behave if we're going to become a significant part of doing what needs to be done. He's written many, many books, and he's been doing this for quite a while, and he's a very articulate voice for his perspective. Dr. Gottlieb.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back here from last year, and it's certainly an honor to be associated with such distinguished and helpful people. And on behalf of the other living beings on planet Earth, thank you all for your work. Facts? You want facts? We got facts. But are they enough, I ask myself. And sadly, I answer myself, they aren't enough. Here's a fact for you. In the Eastern Pacific Ocean, there's something called the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which is a soup or stew of plastic refuse, some places just on the surface of the water, some places 100 feet deep. It's as big as, fill in the blank, you might say Texas, if your information was old, Texas. If your information is more recent, you'd say the United States. That's what we've created. We've rewritten our country in junk on the surface of the Pacific Ocean. You want facts? Here's another fact. Random study of the placental blood of 8 newborn children in St. Louis, 2007, 197 toxic chemicals in that blood. You're born polluted. We're not just riding on the outside of the world, we're riding on the inside of our bodies. But facts will only get you so far. In 1963, that's almost 50 years ago, Rachel Carson said, "We have to test each chemical before it's let loose on the environment." Some people would call that the precautionary principle. And she said, we have to test them in concert, together, because after all, your body does not experience them one at a time. You want facts? She laid it out clearly. Almost 40 years later, the head of the National Institute of Health made the exact same appeal. What this suggests is that it's not a problem of facts. It's not a technological mistake. It's not an oversight. It's not a matter of clumsiness. There's something fundamentally flawed in the culture. It's one thing if somebody misses a few appointments because their alarm clock is broken, but if they miss appointment after appointment after appointment, we suspect that there's something deeper at work, and quite clearly there's something deeper at work in our culture. What is our culture? Well, first thing is it's a culture of acquisitive consumerism. We are what we buy. If we had an educated activist citizenry, as the chairman of the panel suggested this morning, well, one consequence would be we'd stop buying so much stuff and do something else with our time. We have a consciousness that's part of our culture. It's a culture of distraction because of all the machines. I'll explain that in a second after I take this. You get the point. It's a culture of distraction. We have married the machines. Only some of us now are realizing that we are married to vampires. Why do you think the concept of vampire is so popular now? Because the BlackBerry, the computer in front of which I spend far too much time, is a kind of vampire. It's sexy, it's charismatic. You start to make love to it, and you find out that it's sucking your blood. We have a culture in which our emotional life is one of isolation from community. We move, we change religions, we change traditions, we have our nice little houses, or we get drunk, drunk on alcohol, drunk on drugs, drunk on antidepressants, drunk on television, drunk on distraction, drunk on video games, drunk on pornography. We're isolated. Put these all together, and what you have then is a contrast between a ruling elite, I'll get to the ruling elite in a minute, they'll wait, and a culture of people who are often, for the most part, incapable of serious political activism. And that's a big problem. It's a big problem because the ruling elite is and does what every ruling elite does from every political system, take control and perpetuate their power. In a way, and I say this as somebody whose politics are so far to the left, I periodically fall off the planet. In a way, and very sadly, the Republicans are right. If you listen to the presidential hopefuls on the Republican side in their debates, what do they say? Jobs, jobs, job killer, job killer, job. The jobs are good, the job killers are bad. Stop the regulations, blah, 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 blah. And they're right. Why are they right? Because what's going on now is that the ruling elite is engaged in a kind of strike, or at least a kind of slowdown. Where are the jobs when we are sitting on $2 trillion in profits? They are disciplining this country and letting us know, you give us too many regulations, you give us too many controls, you limit our profits, you limit our freedom of action, we won't invest. And if we don't invest, you don't get a job. As long as they control the job market, as long as they control, pardon this old school language, makes me seem like the dinosaur I am, as long as they control the forces of production, where have we heard that line before, then there will be as many jobs as they want, unless there is an aroused, engaged citizenry, unless people storm the gates one way or another, demanding something different, which means that our job unfolds on many fronts. It means we have to build a culture which is an alternative to a culture of distraction and consumerism. It means we have to shut off our machines and talk to each other like human beings, and we have to embody what we know, what we experience, and what we can learn from each other in a mass movement that expresses itself in our churches, in our universities, in NGOs, like everything from the Sierra Club to the National Toxics Movement. It means that elected representatives and the people who own the wealth must know that the people are on the edge of doing something really, really bad, and they better back off. Is it possible for us to do this? Are we so drugged out and pacified by all the toys they've offered over the years that it's impossible for us to move? I don't know. I don't know. I try not to despair, though when I look at the world, I'm often overwhelmed by grief. But I only comfort myself with the honest realization that I'm too ignorant to know what the future holds. Let's write it in a better way. Thank you.
Gina, you get an opportunity to respond if you'd like.
Sure.
I thought they were pretty nice.
I don't know how to respond to all that. I'm not sure that I disagree with anything that's been said. I will say that, Wendell, I still think there's got to be a way that you can, and I don't think there is an inherent conflict in people's lives between wanting to have a job and to respect the earth while you're doing it. I think that it's not inherently a conflict. Is it a conflict in certain economies? Yeah, it is, and there's no question about it. Can we do better? Even when there's a conflict, absolutely, we can minimize it. And thank you for the kind words, Doctor. It was very gracious of you. I will say that go with Godspeed on that streamlining kind of stuff, because it is amazing. You have no idea how much I read, because the rules that we do, I will give you one example. We have a little rule that we're doing that's actually not going to be so little. It's called uniform standards, and it's a methodology for reducing fugitive emissions from stationary sources. Basically, it says how should you do your storage tanks and things like this, flaring, little things like this. It will get enormous reductions. It's 1,000 pages long, the preamble only. Okay. The RIA, it's enormous. It's just very challenging, and you're absolutely right. When you see those go through the process and you see them thrown out in court because you didn't answer one response to comment. When we put out a mercury and air toxic standard, we got 930,000 comments. Now, we're terrified that there may be one buried in the middle of something innocent on purpose that the court can find and say, you know, you didn't exactly answer that question. And that could be enough. So it's amazing. I have 80 people working full-time just reading response to comment on that rule. Okay? That's how it works, and it's very difficult. And I'll tell you, my man, Jamaica Plain is a cool place, and I'm glad you're in it. You know what I would just... The one thing I wanted to kick off on was some of the things you mentioned last, and this is an initiative that I got very engaged in, and I'm still in my heart wanting to return to. And one of the things that I fear the most is that I think one of the biggest problems for the earth right now is that children don't go out and play. Now, I've said this to a million people. It is the biggest problem. I became to that realization with the 90,000th person who came up to me on climate change and pointed that it was snowing out and said that the earth isn't warming. If one more person told me that, I was going to hit them over the head. That's when I realized that we just aren't smart enough. We may be smart enough, we're not educated enough. There's an old Native American saying that says you only conserve what you love, you only love what you know, and you only know what you learn. If a kid doesn't go out in the woods and look at the zillions of shades of green, if they don't go out at night and look at the stars above them and see the glory of the world that we live in, then they might actually think they do control the world and that it's an inconvenience to have all of this pollution and we'll fix it later. It'll be like Sim City, right? And it's all about plugging in, disengaging, not being outside, not being free to think or to interject or to engage with one another, to feel like they need to have a coach give them more time instead of them learning how to play soccer. You know what I mean? The scrappy stuff when we were kids. When I was a kid, my mother didn't let us stay in the house. It was illegal in some way. no matter what the temperature was, we were outside playing. We would turn over a log. That's how I learned the wonders of the world. I realized that there's a colony of things, a city of little creatures. And I realized that I don't know anything about how that works. That's what Rachel Carson discovered. She discovered ecosystems. She understood that if you put DDT out, oh my God, it might not just do what you wanted it to do. It might have other impacts. We are playing with a world in which we know nothing, literally nothing about, and God didn't create it for us to control it. And we need to take that back, and part of it is we need to get disconnected and get our kids out. I launched a program called No Child Left Inside. It proved to be, because I had the POC system. We had families running throughout the entire state of Connecticut and engaging one another again. I had parents calling me up saying it's the first time they have ever done anything unstructured with their children. Ever. We had tug of war, we had three-legged races, we had sack races. We had little kids who thought I was taking them and putting a sack over them and kidnapping them. Because they'd never seen a sack race before. We kicked their butts, the adults. Only the first time, however. The second time, we couldn't quite do it. So it's extremely important for us to think about how disconnected we are right now and to ask that fundamental question that you asked, can we change that? Is it so much now a part of our culture that we just don't know how to participate anymore? I hope not.
I want to sort of underscore this sort of the tension between what Wendell was talking about and what Gina was talking about. There was a man named Joseph Rahm, R-O-M-M, who was Assistant Secretary of Energy, and he wrote a lovely book called Cool Companies, which was about how major big-time companies, we're not talking Ben and Jerry's here, we're talking Toshiba and Toyota, things like that that matter, how they were making their factories more energy efficient and letting in natural light and less emissions and all this kind of stuff. And he had one great story about a auto factory in Southern California, and they changed the windows, and you could control the temperature at your desk, and the line was much better, and they made everything more efficient, and they knocked down their energy consumption by 30%, and they upped their production by 20%. It was a great story, except you find out, what were they making? SUVs. It's great if we make the energy efficiency standards of American automobiles better, twice as much, three times as much. Fabulous. Will we just end up driving more because we don't know what to do with ourselves? I'm not a scientist. I'm not a chemist. But I suspect that a pound of CO2 emitted from a very efficient vehicle has the same effect as a pound of CO2 emitted from a very inefficient vehicle. So if you have twice the efficiency and you drive twice as much, there's a kind of crossover on some graph that some mathematically minded person couldn't put. What we're facing is the biggest thing humanity has ever faced. It's harder than ending slavery. It's harder than giving women the vote. It's harder than freeing colonies from the control by colonial powers, because you can just install new rulers and do the deal with them. This means we actually have to grow up. For 2,500 years at least, certain kinds of religious leaders have said things like, well, we should have compassion on everyone, or we should love our neighbors. Now, everybody knows those kinds of ideas are hopelessly old school, inefficient, impractical. Well, we're certainly not following them in today's world. Look what the consequences.
I'd like to clarify a little bit. There is no conflict between the economy and jobs, or between your aims and jobs, as long as you accept the industrial economy as normal. For one of the aims of industrialism has always been to replace people with equipment, but the more significant thing is one of the tenets of industrialism has always been no expenditure for maintenance, so that you run an agricultural economy on the principles of cheap food and the highest corporate profits. So you're paying only for production. If we were going to pay for maintenance, we'd have many more people involved in all the land using industries that involve growth, biological growth, and we would have rationing in the industries that involve things that burn.